So today we'll be looking at Exodus 16 through 18. These chapters continue the theme that was started at the end of chapter 15, which is God's provision and protection for the people along the journey. As we work through them, though, I want to call our attention to some oddities and seeming contradictions. I've mentioned that we will run into a few of these in the book of Exodus, and here we're actually going to see a cluster of them. And I will be addressing them as we go through them. Some of them are actually quite glaring. And one thing we will see through them, though, is that rather than giving us an excuse to see the Bible as like hodgepodge, accidentally put together, mistakes throughout, what we're actually going to see as we work through them and as I point them out and look at them in their context is that they actually contribute to the theme of this section and that they are the way they are for a reason. Some of these oddities are used by critics at times to try to undermine the credibility of the Bible, but usually the critique boils down to, as I mentioned a couple times already, attempting to enforce modern standards on an ancient text with different literary rules and norms, or honestly just applying literary rules more strictly than we even apply to ourselves. And that's what usually a lot of these critiques boil down to. What these oddities do show, though, is that seeming problems and contradictions that are brought up in the text are not being made up. They are there in the text, and they come from a close reading. But a close reading should also be a contextual reading, and that is what I'm going to be trying to help us today as we see these oddities, as we see these things that seem out of place, seem contradictory. I'm going to help us to see them in context and see what's going on. So let's work through these chapters and see what they have to say. The first 12 verses of chapter 16 were what was just read, so I'm not going to reread them. But I want us to first just notice the timing of when these things are happening. Remember at the end of the previous chapter that we discussed last week, the people had been at Elim, and there had been the 12 springs of water and 70 palm trees. So there was enough for the people, and they had what they needed at the time. But then from Elim, they set out, and we read that the congregation came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai, on the 15th day of the second month. So this has been a few weeks. And apparently, their provisions by this time have run out, so they begin to grumble. And they grumble to Moses and Aaron, saying that it would have been better that they had died back in Egypt, where at least there had been meat and bread. So we're pretty quickly wanting to go back to Egypt again. That's going to be a repeated theme, again and again and again, that we're going to see a lot, so keep this in mind. In God's answer, we see actually the first of the oddities that we're going to see throughout these chapters, and it seems like a contradiction. In verse 4, we read that, "The Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I am about to rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a day's portion every day, that I may test them, whether or not they will walk in my law or not. And then on the sixth day, when they prepare what they bring in, it will be twice as much as they gather daily.'" Verse 4 reads that God is going to rain bread from heaven every day, and that they are going to gather a day's portion every day, and that the people are to gather twice on the sixth day. And it also makes mention to God's law. Verse 5 goes on to explain, again, that they're going to gather twice as much on the sixth day, so it seems also to be a Sabbath teaching coming up here. And this reference to God's law and the beginning of what's going to be clarified even more later seems to be a teaching about the Sabbath. But the Mosaic law and the Sabbath ordinances have not been given yet. So we seem to have a textual oddity here, something that seems out of order. What helps us to understand this is to first understand the definition of the word that is being used in our translation as law. And then we also need to pay attention to the flow of the narrative as it unfolds. So first, this word law, or Torah, it does not mean, strictly speaking, its primary definition is not a set of codified laws. That's what we tend to think of it as. And it does at times refer to the Mosaic law, a specific set of laws. It is used in that way throughout Scripture. But the word law, Torah, has a broader primary meaning that simply just means direction, instruction, teaching, guidance. And we read at the end of the previous chapter that God had already started to give them rules and statutes. And at that time, we talked about in that context, primarily what was being taught with the rules and statutes at the end of 15 is that the people are simply to be loyal to God. That is the primary rule and statute that they have so far, is that they are to look to God, to be loyal to him, to listen when he speaks to them, and to do it, and to obey him. So they have been given a sort of law and an instruction already. And then also, notice in chapter 16 that we are going to see instructions given about the Sabbath that are going to later become part of the Mosaic Law. And as we see this chapter unfold, we are going to see that the people are going to be learning about the Sabbath as the days happen. So I don't think that this reference here to law, this reference to Sabbath, I don't think this needs to be out of order. I think you can read the law as a general way of saying we need to listen to God's instruction as he gives it. And then this Sabbath actually seems, they seem to be being taught about the Sabbath as the chapter unfolds. So I don't think we have to say that this chapter is out of order and that the Mosaic Law somehow has already been given. I think we just need to let the chapter speak to itself. So as we work through this chapter, if I could flip to the next page in my notes, we are going to see continued instruction. In verses 6 through 8, Moses and Aaron answer the people. And what's interesting is the answer they give to the people contains a lot more detail than the answer that God gave Moses, which honestly just reminds us that oftentimes what we see in the scripture is we see a summary of things that are happening and things that are said. We aren't always given every single word and every single event of everything that happens. If we were, the book would be a lot longer. Because it seems obvious that God gave Moses further instruction. And notice also that Moses leaves out the instruction about the sixth day and seems to give that instruction later in pieces as it is happening, kind of as a teaching tool. And I think that's really helpful for the people because it's a new concept to them. They're learning about it. He's going to teach them as they go so that it's as clear as possible as he teaches them. And he and Moses tell the people that in the evening and the morning they will see the glory of God and know that it was the Lord who brought them out of Egypt, which seems a lot like the purpose of the plagues. We have this continued purpose here that they will know the Lord and see his power, see his provision. They also point out to the people that they are grumbling against God, not against Moses, not against Aaron. It wasn't Moses and Aaron that delivered the people. It wasn't Moses and Aaron that promised to bring the people to the promised land. It was God. So grumbling about how God is doing it and the circumstances that are happening is not grumbling against Moses and Aaron's leadership. It's not their plan. It's grumbling directly against God. And that's what Moses and Aaron point out to the people. And then in 9 and 12, God speaks to the people. Before he does so, and to make this point even more clear that the people are grumbling directly against God, Moses has Aaron tell the people to come before the Lord, presumably meaning that they come closer to the pillar. We're not sure exactly what it means, but that seems to be what's going on in the context. And then as soon as Aaron tells them to do so, the glory of the Lord appears in the cloud. We are given, disappointingly, no details about what this means, just that the glory appeared in the cloud. So whatever that happened to look like, it was more obvious that God was present. And he somehow displayed his glory, and a voice was heard through the clouds. And the Lord then speaks to Moses, but really to the people, because Moses doesn't have to repeat what was said. And the Lord tells them that he has heard their grumbling and that he will give them meat and bread so that they may know that he is the Lord. Again, this theme that keeps coming up again and again and again. And then we see in verses 13 through 21, which is just after what was read, we're going to see what happens in the first 5 days. So I'm going to read these verses. In the evening, quail came up and covered the camp, and in the morning, dew lay around the camp. And when the dew had gone up, there was on the face of the wilderness a fine flake-like thing, fine as frost, on the ground. And when the people of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "What is it?" For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, "It is the bread that the Lord has given you to eat. This is what the Lord has commanded. Gather of it, each one of you, as much as you can eat. You shall eat each take an omer, according to the number of people that each of you has in his tent." And the people of Israel did so. They gathered some more, some less. But when they measured it with an omer, whoever gathered much had nothing left over, and whoever gathered little had no lack. Each of them gathered as much as he could eat. And Moses said to them, "Let no one leave any of it until the morning." But they did not listen to Moses. Some left part of it till the morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them. Morning by morning they gathered it, each as much as he could eat. But when the sun grew hot, it melted. So in these first 5 days, we see the provision that the Lord is giving them. The quail, which hadn't really even been brought up to this point besides provision in the evening, are given all of half a verse, because the quail are not the point of this chapter. The manna is the point of the chapter. Quail, by the way, are a migratory bird that land exhausted and in large numbers on their migration from Europe to Africa or back, depending on the time of year. And we read later in a similar account in the book of Numbers that what seems to happen here is that God causes a strong wind to cause a group of these quails that are migrating to just happen to land exactly where the Israelites are, exactly when they happen to be there. So these quail are given in the evening as meat for the people. And then in the morning, when the dew evaporates, a fine flake-like thing is left for the people to gather that they aren't really sure what it is. And Moses explains to them, this is what God has provided for you for bread every day. And Moses explains to them that they are to gather an omer, or about 2 liters if you want to put into current measurements, for each person, which would be enough for the day, and they are not to leave any until the morning, which seems to be a test from the Lord to make sure that the people will learn to have faith and trust in his daily provision. Some people ignored this command, and the bread was left until the morning, and that bread got worms and stank. There is a substance, by the way, that the Bedouins still collect to this day and eat and call manna. This substance, though, doesn't quite match what we read here. There are some strikingly miraculous qualities about it, like the fact that on 6 days of the week, if you keep it, it goes bad, and then magically on the sixth day, if you keep it, it doesn't go bad, and you have it for the seventh day, and the fact that it all just disappears magically. There's a lot of qualities about what's going on here that don't quite seem to match, but it could have been this thing, and God is just causing it to exhibit characteristics far out of its normal state. We're not exactly sure, but either way, there are definitely miraculous elements of what's happening here with this manna. This isn't, it can't be explained fully by anything that we know in the region. And then the sixth and the seventh day, during these days, the people are given instructions about the Sabbath. I'm going to read verses 22 to 30. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much bread, 2 omers each. And when all the leaders of the congregation came and told Moses, he said to them, this is what the Lord has commanded. Tomorrow is a day of solemn rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake and boil what you will boil, and all that is left over lay aside to be kept till the morning. So they laid it aside till the morning, as Moses commanded them, and it did not stink. There were no worms in it. Moses said, eat it today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. 6 days you will gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. On the seventh day, some of the people went out to gather, but they found none. And the Lord said to Moses, how long will you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore, on the sixth day, he gives you bread for 2 days. Remain each of you in his place. Let no one go out in his place on the seventh day. So the people rested on the seventh day. These verses, as an aside, just really remind me of the whole God with Abraham thing, where God told him, like, the promise will come through your seed. And then Abram and Sarah try to help him. Or he like asks, like, was it going to be like this person that's in my house? No, it's your seed. So that Abram and Sarai, like, Sarai has him have Hagar, and then he has a son through Hagar. And then God's like, no, like, literally with you and Sarah. Like, that's kind of what happens here again in this text, is God has Moses tell them, you take 2 omers, and you're going to have it for the next day. It's not going to be there. Some people go out anyway and look for the manna, and it's not there. And God's like, okay, let me spell it out for you. This is how the Sabbath works. Stay in your place and rest. There's going to be no manna out there. You don't need to gather it up. The stuff you kept on the sixth day will stay until the seventh day. That's how this day works, so please do this. So he just kind of lays it out even more explicitly for the people. And, sorry, I lost my place in the notes for a second there. So we see all this happen. And before we go on to verse 31 to 36, I want to just take a moment to appreciate what was being taught to the people through the manna. The chapter opened with the people complaining about a lack of meat and bread and saying that they would have preferred to stay in the land of slavery, where at least they had food. They say, at least we had meat pots and bread. In response to this complaint, God provides not only meat and bread, the specific things that they had been complaining about not having, but he also provides them rest. something that they would not have gotten in the land of slavery. The institution and instruction of the Sabbath is no accident. This isn't a textual anomaly and something out of order here. This is a specific response from God to a specific complaint from the people to give a clear teaching. God is showing them how much better it is to serve him than Pharaoh. He will provide not only their needs, bread, but even at times their wants, quail. They only get that for one night, by the way. And not only this, but he will also give them rest. The Sabbath and the manna, in fact, are laws of grace. We tend to think of the law as restrictive and oppressive, but the law of the Sabbath is a law of grace. It is a gift given to a people newly liberated from slavery. They are reminders that God's grace is new every morning. The people were to gather, but if they kept what was extra, it would be bad the next morning. They were supposed to go gather more because they will find more. There will be more manna. There will be more grace. And they are required to gather twice as much on the sixth day as a reminder that they are graciously told to take a day off every week, something they never would have gotten in slavery. Even as the people doubt and disobey, the manna continues. God's grace continues. In fact, for 40 years, the manna never stopped. Even during the times of disobedience and rebellion that you read throughout the rest of the Pentateuch until they get to the Promised Land, even through all of these, throughout all their journey to the Promised Land, the manna never stopped. God's daily grace never stopped. There was a clear teaching being given through the manna. And because of this, in the next few verses, we have what basically amounts to an appendix about the manna. More information to make this chapter about manna even longer, because it's kind of important. So in 31 to 36, we read, "Now the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and the taste of it was like wafers made with honey. And then Moses said, 'This is what the Lord has commanded. Let an omer of it be kept throughout your generations, so that they may see the bread with which I fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And Moses said to Aaron, 'Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it and place it before the Lord to be kept throughout your generations. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron placed it before the testimony to be kept.' The people of Israel ate the manna for 40 years till they came to the habitable land. They ate the manna till they came to the border of the land of Canaan. An omer is a tenth part of an ephah." In these verses that, like I said, basically amount to an appendix, we see a few things, and we see actually a few textual anomalies, some oddities that are going on here. In verse 31, we are given the name and the description of the bread. And then in 32 to 34, we read that Moses commanded Aaron to keep an omer of manna in a jar before the testimony, which refers to the Ark of the Covenant before it's built. That's interesting. And then we also have this instruction to do this and be kept for generation that we're not actually even sure when this happened, but it happened and it's placed here, not later when it's happened after they actually have the Ark of Covenant. And then we also, in 35 to 36, see notes that are quite obviously added after the people had arrived in Israel and long after, in fact, long enough that they don't even know what an omer is anymore. They have to define an omer. We know that the omer is actually only used as a standard of measurement here in this chapter in the Pentateuch, and it passed out of usage among the Israelites later on in history. So we don't actually know when this note was added, but it was added later to make sure that people understood what was going on. So we know at a minimum that the manna ended after Moses died. So these notes were at least added in the time of Joshua, and we're not actually sure when all of these notes were added. So there is a note here, and there is a reason here about why they're added. And it also causes possibly a question about, well, I thought Moses wrote all of the books of the Pentateuch. Didn't he write every single word? Mostly. So the Pentateuch are referred to as the Law of Moses, or even just Moses at times throughout the Bible. But that doesn't mean that Moses wrote every single word. In fact, it's quite obvious in a few places, especially here, that he didn't write every single word. Multiple edits and additions, just like these verses, have been added after his death, with some possibly being added quite a while after his death. The law of Moses often refers literally to the laws given in Exodus and elsewhere, or it is a shorthand way of referring to the Pentateuch, since much of its context is about Moses and the law. This same shorthand method is also being used when it says that Moses wrote the book. It is quite obvious that he wrote much, if not most, the vast majority, of the Pentateuch. It is quite obvious through details, through word choices, some of which I've been pointing out as we go, how there's a lot of Arabian or Egyptian influence to a lot of the words and the roots that are happening throughout this account here. And one of them, honestly, is the fact that the word Omer is in there. Like, the fact that this measurement standard was used is an argument for the fact that it was written at a time when they actually used the Omer as a standard, and then later they had to add an edit to define what that actually meant. So it's actually an argument for the fact that it was written a lot earlier. And then also another example, which this one kind of gets into a little Hebrew excursus here, but the question that the people ask, what is it? Is written and preserved in an ancient Hebrew dialect that very likely had an Egyptian influence, where the people had just come out of. The question they ask is manhu, with man being what? But the normal Hebrew word for what is not man, it's just ma. Man, though, was, like I just said, an ancient Hebrew dialect that was in use at the time after the people had come out of the land of Egypt and as their language had been influenced a little bit by the Egyptian language. So even that is also an argument for the early writing of it. And then also the fact that it's kept here, this man word, also is kept to keep the play on words that's seen later with, it says, the house of Israel called its name manna, which in the Hebrew is just man. How we say manna is basically a development of languages that I'm not really going to get into. But it's kept there for that play on words. But getting back to the flow and the point of the narrative, the fact that these notes are added here not only does not detract from Mosaic authorship, but it also helps to reinforce the whole point of this section. These notes are added to help future readers know and remember manna in detail from generation to generation to understand this chapter in its details, so that they know what these words mean. They know what an omer means. They know what manna, potentially reading later at a time where they don't have manna to look at anymore, that they know what it was like. That they can have concrete images of this lesson that is being taught. So there's a reason these notes are added here. They are a reminder of God's constant provision and grace through the 40 years of wandering, and a reminder that this God who gave constant provision and grace is still the same God who gives new grace every day. This chapter is so important that these notes were added to make sure that that message would be clear. As we continue through our chapters that we're looking at today, this theme is going to continue in chapters 17 and 18. In chapter 17, we see that the people thirst for water at Rephidim. So after their complaint and their grumble of food has been satisfied, and even more so, they've been given rest, we have them now complaining about water. In the first seven verses of chapter 17, we read, "All the congregation, the people of Israel, moved on from the wilderness of Sin by stages, according to the commandment of the Lord, and camped at Rephidim. But there was no water for the people to drink. Therefore the people quarreled with Moses and said, 'Give us water to drink.' And Moses said to them, 'Why do you quarrel with me? Why do you test the Lord?'" Again, pointing to their actual source of their quarrel. "But the people thirsted there for water, and the people grumbled against Moses and said, 'Why did you bring us up out of Egypt?'" Haven't we heard that before? "'Why did you bring us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?' So Moses cried to the Lord, 'What shall I do with this people? They are almost ready to stone me.' And the Lord said to Moses, 'Pass on before the people, taking with you some of the elders of Israel, and take in your hand the staff with which you struck the Nile, and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock, and water shall come out of it, and the people will drink.' And Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel, and he called the name of the place Massah and Meribah, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, and because they tested the Lord by saying, 'Is the Lord among us or not?'" This word translated quarrel, that we see that the people are quarreling with Moses and asking, "Is God among us or not?" This is a stronger word than we've seen yet. In 15 and 16, it was more of a generic word for grumbling, like, "Hey, we need food. We need water. Where's the food? Where's the water? Now we have more of almost like a legislative bent to it. It's like they are an aggrieved party that is bringing a direct and confrontational quarrel to Moses and to God. But even still, we see God respond not with anger, but with more grace, more patience, more provision. And he demonstrates his presence as well. God tells Moses to take some of the elders, take a staff that he struck the Nile, and strike a rock. For God will be standing there on the rock and will provide water. This all Moses does, and the question of the people, is the Lord among us or not, is answered in a clear demonstration of his provision and his presence. If you're curious, there are formations, by the way, in that area of soft, porous limestone that have the ability to hold a good amount of water and will release it if cracked or broken. But they don't usually hold this much water. There are a lot of people, and we're also told they have livestock. So, yeah, this is a natural thing, but God's doing stuff with it that isn't natural. Again, God again takes something natural, as we've seen many times throughout this book, and makes it miraculous, calling the people to trust and to follow him, to look to him. Wait a minute. This pattern is starting to sound an awful lot like Christ calling Peter and James and John by taking something natural, fish, and making it miraculous with a giant haul of fish that nobody could explain because they had just been fishing all night and there weren't any fish. The people are here in the desert and there isn't any water. And then God says, go strike this rock, which at times sometimes has a little bit of water. He's like, no, it's going to give you water to satisfy all of your thirst. And then Christ goes and does the same thing later with something else, with a similar concept. We'll get back to that. The next thing we see in these chapters is in verses 8 to 16, we see that Israel defeats the Amalekites. While the people are at Rephidim, the Amalekites come and fight with them. We read later in Deuteronomy that the Amalekites made a surprise attack on the rear and on the stragglers, killing some of those who were lagging behind as the people traveled. These verses 8 to 16, read, then Amalek came and fought with Israel at Rephidim. So Moses said to Joshua, choose for us men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the staff of God in my hand. So Joshua did as Moses told him and fought with Amalek, while Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. Whenever Moses held up his hand, Israel prevailed. Whenever he lowered his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hand grew weary, so they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it, while Aaron and Hur held up his hands, one on one side and one on the other. So his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. And Joshua overwhelmed Amalek and his people with the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, write this as a memorial in a book, and recite it in the ears of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the memory of Amalek from under heaven. And Moses built an altar and called the name of it, the Lord is my banner, saying, a hand upon the throne of the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. Joshua here, who, by the way, is mentioned for the first time, and we're given actually really no description of him. We kind of find out more about him as the book and as the Pentateuch goes on. But Joshua is ordered to gather an army and to prepare a fight. And then on the next day, Moses is going to stand on the top of a hill holding up a staff. Moses, by the way, who, if you're curious why he's doing that, one of the reasons, one, he's just too old to fight at this point. He's not in the fighting age anymore. But again, he's just going to go, he's going to go stand on a hill, and he's going to hold up a staff, and then when it's up, Israel's winning, and then when it's down, Israel is not winning. This really seems like a strange battle plan. But we kind of run into that a lot throughout the Old Testament. There are a lot of really strange battle plans that God gives the people, usually because they're teaching a lesson about how the battle is being fought and won. And this is reinforced and really clarified for us in the verses themselves, which is helpful, because we read at the end, we read that they build an altar to remember this battle, and they call it, the Lord is my banner. By holding up the staff of God, Moses was effectively raising the symbol of God's presence and God's power to be a banner to the people as they fought. The same staff that had been used by God for the plagues on Egypt was now used to bring defeat to the army of Amalek. In the ancient understanding, Moses' role, him standing on the hill and holding this staff for the people to look at and to be the banner of the people, in the ancient understanding, especially because he's holding a staff and not actually a literal banner, but in the ancient understanding, he would have been viewed as some sort of channel or mediator of divine power being brought down onto this spot to empower his people. But what's interesting is if you read ancient accounts where there's kind of that similar role going on, this is fulfilled by like a superhuman or like a demigod or like somebody who is just like this insanely strong person who never flags, never wearies. But in this text, we read that Moses gets tired. He needs to sit on a rock. He needs a couple people to help him hold his hands up, to keep his hands up the rest of the day. He isn't a superhuman because the battle is not being won by Moses. He is not the source of the power. And really, the staff that he's holding up is not the source of the power either. What it represents is, the Lord is my banner. That is what is happening in this battle. God, as made clear throughout this entire book, God brings the victory. Not Moses, not Joshua, not the army. They're called to fight, but God ultimately brings the victory. There are a lot of interesting things, by the way. If you look at verse 16 there at the end, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation. There are a lot of really interesting things about the history of the relationship between the Israelites and the Amalekites and the related clans, both before and after this event, and then how verse 16 plays out throughout the rest of the Old Testament. I do not have time for that today. If you're curious, you can ask me. It's probably better for like a series through Joshua or as you see that story unfold throughout the rest of the Old Testament. So unfortunately, I don't have time to get into that today. But the bigger point is, again, this: the Lord is my banner. That this victory, this power, this presence is from God. The people are to look to God for this. That is the point. Just like the manna was about more than the manna, Moses holding up the staff is about more than Moses holding up a piece of wood. It's about a message that's behind it. The next thing we see is chapter 18. I'm not going to read chapter 18 for the sake of time. But as we continue discussing the events of these chapters, it may seem kind of random that I am including chapter 18. But there's one main reason, and I would argue a very good reason, that I include this chapter in this section. And that is that the text itself tells us that it goes with the chapter before it. And how does it do that? It does it, ironically, by taking it out of chronological order. And what I mean by that is, if you read closely, there are some keys in this chapter that tell us that this is not happening where the people currently are. If you follow the events going on in this chapter and kind of pay attention to some of the key words, some chronological markers that are happening, we read in verse 5 that the people are already at the mountain. But they don't get there until the next chapter. So we've kind of jumped forward a little bit here before we actually get to the mountain of God. And they also apparently have been given laws and statutes that Moses is trying to help them apply and enforce all day for multiple days, which means they're somewhere stationary where they've been for a while and they have a law that they're applying. That sounds a lot like stuff that happens later. So yeah, we've jumped in the chronological order here. In fact, piecing the details that we see in this chapter with details about this account that we see later in Numbers and Deuteronomy, it seems that Jethro and Moses' family actually likely arrived while the people were at Mount Sinai and like near the end of the year that they're there at Mount Sinai. So we've jumped forward like a whole year in the order of events here, and then we go back to the flow of the narrative in the next chapter. So what is going on here? Why is this chapter all of a sudden just like stuck with the chapter 16 and chapter 17? It's here because it continues the same exact theme. We're grouping things together here that are all teaching the same theme. It continues the theme of God's provision by showing that God also used the advice of Moses' father-in-law to help Moses and the people. So we've got another theme of provision here, just a little bit different take on it. God's using other people as well. And second, it also creates a clear contrast between the Amalekites and the Midianites that will be played out through the rest of the Old Testament as well. Basically, as a way of showing that not all of the surrounding peoples were enemies and trying to kill Moses and the Israelites. Some of them were actually helpful, like the Midianites. But this first reason, this God's providence, this is really, I'd argue, why this is here. It's reinforced throughout this chapter. Verses 1 through 12 are peppered with mentions of God's deliverance and protection from Egypt and along the way to Mount Sinai. And then 22 to 23 summarize the advice as making things easier for Moses. In fact, I'm going to read the very end there. It says, starting in 22, basically after Jethro had advised him, like, why are you judging everybody? Like, delegate this task. So starting in 22, and let them judge the people at all times. Every great matter they shall bring to you, but any small matter they shall decide themselves. So it will be easier for you, and they will bear the burden with you. If you do this, God will direct you. You will be able to endure, and all this people will go to their place in peace. So Moses listened to the voice of his father-in-law and did all that he had said. Moses chose able men out of all of Israel and made them heads over the people, chiefs of thousands, of hundreds and fifties and tens. And they judged the people at all times. Any hard case they brought to Moses, but any small matter they decided themselves. Then Moses let his father-in-law depart, and he went away to his own country. So in these verses, we see that things are made easier. The burden is shared. The people are going to go to where they are going in peace. And that we see this reference here in 23, God will direct you. I don't think that's an accident here. I think it's purposely tying this theme that we've just seen in 16 and 17, that this provision is coming from God through somebody else. But this provision, this advice, this needed advice to help Moses share the burden, to make things easier for him and the people, to help smooth their way, even just logistically, as they're continuing to the promised land. This is from God. Through somebody else, but from God. In other words, God's direction and providence is being continued here in this chapter. So we include this chapter here to kind of close out this grouping of content about God's providence, his presence, his power, and his victory. So we've kind of clumped that all together. And then in chapter 19, we're going to get back to the narrative and then traveling, continuing to Mount Sinai. We'll get there next week. But that's the end of this grouping here at the end of chapter 18. So what does all this mean? Well, to Moses and the Israelites, these chapters taught many things about God and his provision, his presence, his protection. The people grumbled for food and water, asking if the Lord was among them or not. And they also needed military and even just judicial, logistical help. For all of these needs, God made himself seen and known. He provided manna. He provided quail. He provided water. He provided victory in battle, and he provided advice. We do not see him get angry in these chapters at the complaints or at the needs of the people. Rather, he comforts them with his presence and his provision. He provides, he protects. He does this in a way, though, that serves as a continual and clear lesson to the people. They still had to collect and prepare the manna. The people still had to gather and drink the water. Joshua and the army had to fight. Moses had to hold up the staff. Moses and the judges had to judge. They still had to do these things. They didn't happen magically. But we see that in all of these things, that they all ultimately come from God. The people are called to effort, but the result is ultimately up to God. Sounds a lot like something we see here in the New Testament quite a bit. And they also don't happen without a call to faith and loyal obedience. There were rules about the manna, rules that encouraged them to faith. I don't know what that is, sorry. Rules that encouraged them to faith and to obedience, to trust in God's continued provision. The manna went bad if they kept it because they were to trust that it would be there the next day. And Moses had to continue to be helped, to hold up the staff. He had to work. People had to help him. But it was all a sign of continuing to look to God for the victory. Throughout all of these things, a clear message from God was being given. Look to me for all these things. For these things are ultimately from me. You are called to work, to gather, to fight. But I am the source of your provision, of your victory. The manna, the quail, the water are more than about satisfying hunger and thirst. They were about learning to have faith and trust in God and God alone. Just as God had wiped out every god of the Egyptians and shown that he is God alone. So now he is even dealing on the level of daily provision and saying that for these things, you look to me as well. To the people who kept saying that it would have been better to go back to Egypt, God kept saying, don't look there for what you need. Look to me. Isn't it interesting that when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness, he answered Satan, man shall not live by bread alone. It was about more than the bread. The full verse that he was quoting was Deuteronomy 8:3, and it says, and he humbled you and let you hunger and fed you with the manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that he might make you know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Christ knew that the manna was more than about just the bread. In fact, he knew that he was the fulfillment of the manna. He is the greater bread from heaven. He said of himself, I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me shall not hunger, and whoever believes in me shall never thirst. The ultimate provision of grace that is new and plentiful each day is found in the work of Christ. Like manna, it is grace and forgiveness available, even when we fail him. Through faith and trust in him, we will one day have our final and forever Sabbath rest that was also being taught through the manna. And his faithful grace, just like that manna was constant provision for 40 years, his faithful grace will bring those who place their faith and trust in him into the promised land of eternity. Christ also knew that he is our ultimate banner. He is our ultimate victory. In John 16:33, we read, I have said these things to you that in me you may have peace. In the world you will have tribulation. You will have to fight. You will have to endure. But take heart. I have overcome the world. We know which side wins. We may suffer here on earth just as he did, but we know the end of the story. His victory also, ironically, was brought about through a piece of wood on a hill. But his was not a staff being held up. His was a cross that his suffering, his weary, his dying body was held to with nails. What looked, though, like defeat was turned to victory when his grave became empty, when he rose in victory over sin and death, and as a sign and promise that one day these things will finally and forever be defeated. Because he knows that he is our banner. Lastly, just as God used Jethro, so Christ also knew that we need help from others as well. And that is why he has established and ordained this thing called the church. That we may share each other's burdens, that we may work to understand and apply scripture together, and that we may help each other to hold fast to the faith. Because these lessons, these chapters, they weren't just about the manna. They weren't just about water from a rock. They weren't just about victory over an enemy, because they're going to have more enemies. They're going to need more victories. These were about something more. The message through all of the content of these chapters was look to me. I am your provision. I am your banner. I am what you need. Let's pray. Dear Lord, I thank you that you care for your people, that you give us what we need, at times even what we want, but more importantly, you call us through wherever we are in life to look to you, because you ultimately are what we truly need. I thank you that you taught this message throughout all of the Old Testament, and that Christ, when you came here on earth and lived among us, that you continued this message, that you continued to call people to you, that you met them where they were, that you did meet physical, temporal needs, but you did so pointing them to their eternal need and their spiritual need. And I pray that as we face the sufferings and the shortages of life, as we face trials, that we will remember the lesson behind all of these provisions that you have given all along, that we are ultimately to look to you, and that one day these things will be no more. that one day we will enter into a promised land with you. And I pray that we would trust you on the journey. I pray all this in your name. Amen.